This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You remember the wide open promise of the World Wide Web, right? This was to be the untrammeled, free-range domain of digital liberation, a new world of freedom. Well, yes and no. You can search for whatever you like, but type in democracy in China's blogosphere, or human rights, or women in Iran, and you're getting nothing. Email trails are sending dissidents to jail. Whole realms of thought are being filtered right off the web, and American companies are helping. Now the U.S. government has subpoenaed search records by the millions, and the NSA is reading email, maybe yours. Up next on Point, Big Brother, American companies, and the web. Joining me now from New York is Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia University. He's co-author of the upcoming book, Who Controls the Internet? Illusions of a Borderless World. Tim Wu, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, and hello, Tom.
Hi. So here we've had this little cascade of web-related, restrictive, censoring, filtering, snooping kind of news in the last week and more. What's going on? Why is the free range suddenly a realm of so much surveillance and intervention?
Well, I think suddenly is maybe a misleading term. These are trends that have been going on for the last 5 years, even 7 years. This all kind of began, I think, for many people when Yahoo back in the early 2000s was forced to take down Nazi paraphernalia by the French government. So I think we're suddenly seeing a lot of things boiling to the surface that have been in development for a long time.
You say, you remind us that the web was seen as the international borderless realm. You say, in fact, borders are coming in like crazy, that the sort of lines we see on the map are increasingly drawn across the web as well. How is that happening, and what's the consequence of it?
Well, it's interesting. The way the web was designed originally, it was ageographical. It had no particular carve-outs for countries. But governments eventually figured out that behind this web were these companies, large intermediaries, search engines like Yahoo and Google, internet service providers.
Yep.
And so instead of controlling people directly, they instead control the people who control you. And so that's how, in general, governments have reasserted their power.
They control the people that control you, meaning what?
Meaning that it's very difficult for, let's say, the Chinese government to police a billion internet users, but it's much less difficult for China to control the search engines that let people get information in the first place or the internet service providers who provide the information access in the first place.
And that brings us to Microsoft, to Yahoo, to, in the States, AOL, and Google abroad. Are American companies becoming facilitators for government intervention, government repression on the web?
Well, there's different levels of involvement. They've been in this role since the late 90s. There's been an incredible flock of American investment to China, and most of this is designed to create products that the Chinese government wants, since the Chinese government is the main client. So, yes, there's definitely a facilitation role played by a range of American companies, from Yahoo, Cisco, and other similar, even eBay.
But in all these cases, we're talking about filtering, we're talking about censoring. What are the main tools that these companies put at the disposal of governments who want to control, to surveil the web?
Yeah, it's interesting. In my own experience, I spent some time in China working on the marketing of these kind of products in my own experience. And what we did is we generally took products that were designed to filter corporate access. So, you know, the worker at his desk who's they're trying to block from getting the Sports Illustrated took those same technologies and showed that they could be used to stop people from getting to, let's say, democracy websites.
You're in the private sector, you're in China, and you're showing, that is, you're saying to the Chinese government, we can help you squelch democracy, let us show you how?
Well, I never said that, but companies that were involved in these efforts made it obvious that the filtering technologies that were meant to control corporate workers could just as easily be used for other purposes without necessarily indicating what those other purposes were. But yes, I think that was definitely something that happened in the late 90s and early 2000s, still going on today.
And at this point, you say these are fairly well embedded in many countries. There's filtering, screening, censoring. Even now, with Yahoo's help, China cracking down on particular dissidents, sending one journalist to jail, 10 years.
That's right. This is particularly true in China, and it's less true. I think what China is doing is trying to change the default of the Internet. That is, it's trying to change what the basic assumption is. Our assumption is it's unfiltered with exceptions. The Chinese government is trying to make it so that by default, the expectation is that it will be controlled. Yeah, sorry.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may. Tim Wu, stand by. Joining us from Toronto is Ronald Diebert. He's director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, which researches digital media and world politics. He's professor of political science at the University of Toronto, works with the Open Net Initiative. Ronald Diebert, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've done a lot of research on this. I wish you'd put some meat on the bones of this kind of closing of the web, surveillance of the web story that we're becoming increasingly aware of. Give us some examples of what you have found, of what's actually going on out there.
Well, the research that I'm a part of is a project, as you mentioned, called the Open Net Initiative, and our goal there has been to document empirically patterns of internet censorship and surveillance worldwide through a combination of in-field experts and trusted volunteers and technical means of interrogation. And by that I mean we actually have a suite of tools that we distribute around the world that help us map and document almost in a forensic way what's being filtered, how it's being filtered, and at what level. And we've been doing this now for 3 years, and we've released 9 country reports. And
that sounds kind of antiseptic, but in fact what you do is take your laptop loaded with the software into the country, sit down, hook up to their web, and see what's there and what's not. Have I got that right?
That's one technique. We have a number of different methods. One would be, as you say, kitting up a laptop of a trusted volunteer who goes in maybe to a hotel or internet cafe. But we also have black box computers, we call them, that mm-hmm. we install in the countries, as well as remote probes that we undertake from here at the University of Toronto, where we connect to computers remotely and essentially map it from the inside out. One of my colleagues described, I think, appropriately as kind of taking an MRI of the internet from within national firewalls of these countries. And what we found, to get back to your original question, is that when we started, there were a handful of countries that were doing this. The scale has increased enormously. We're now looking at literally dozens of countries that engage in internet filtering of traffic that you've been talking about. And the scope of what's being filtered has increased as well. When our studies first started, we would come across mostly filtering of pornography. But now the type of information that is being filtered by governments is it covers the entire spectrum from human rights information to dissidents to blogs and so on.
Ronald Diebert, make it gritty, make it real for us. Give us the most specific examples you can that you've found that sort of bring home what's going on.
Well, in our country reports on Iran and China, for example, we found in our testing that a lot of the English language content, sites that you might expect or presume that the government would want to filter, like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, those sites are generally accessible. What those countries were doing increasingly was focusing on local language content in the Chinese language. So searches for human rights information relating specifically to Tiananmen Square, for example, in the Chinese language would be filtered, whereas English language content would not. And so, the same would go for Iran. So this demonstrates to us an increasing sophistication of these countries' efforts. And I would say that sophistication is directly tied to the use of increasingly sophisticated Western commercial filtering software that Tim Wu is talking about.
We'll look at that. So if I'm sitting in Beijing and I type into my search box there Tiananmen protests or human rights, what happens?
Well, if you did a search for those terms in Google in English, you might get back probably about only 80% of the equivalent search you'd make here in Canada or in the United States. If you did the same search in the Chinese language, you would only get back maybe 10% of what you would see if you did the same Chinese language search on Google here in North America. So it's a completely different internet that you're looking at.
We've been joined from Paris in France. Julien Penn joins us. He's head of the Internet and Technology Desk at Reporters Without Borders. They've been invited to speak at congressional hearings next month on the Internet and human rights. Julien Penn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Tim Wu says this has been going on for years now, but your group documents the consequences of Internet snooping and filtering and censorship. How serious an issue is this?
Well, the first consequence is that we have now more than 60% jailed around the world for just for articles published on the Internet, which means that now, I mean, we're a press freedom organization, but we realize that the journalists were not the only one to be harassed and sometimes jailed for what they publish. In certain countries, you mentioned China, also in Iran and in Tunisia, you can be jailed up to 10 years just because of a few posts on the Internet or a few articles you try to publish abroad.
And that happens. So much of the news, the press, is becoming digital, going to the web. What does it say about the future of press freedom or freedom of speech if we've got this kind of surveillance and crackdown, Julien?
Well, the problem is in many countries there's no independent press, not at all. I mean, if you're, we're talking about Iran. Since 2002, you can't find any independent newspaper or TV or radio. So the former journalists who usually got fired from their newspaper, they're trying to find a new way to express themselves. And that's why, for example, they turn to weblogs. And that's why it's so important now to defend not only professional journalists, but also bloggers and all Internet users, because they are doing the job that journalists should do in certain countries. So I'm not saying that journalists are not taking risk anymore, but I'm saying that they are not the only one we should defend. And I think it's much more difficult to make people understand that a blogger in these countries can provide us with an information which is sometimes better than professional journalists. And because we are so used to the debate in the U.S. Mm-hmm. where, you know, bloggers are considered as just spreading rumors and mm-hmm. false information. It's totally a different situation. It's the opposite in these countries.
Julien Penn, what about the role of U.S. companies or other Western companies as well, European? I'm looking here at a Reporters Without Borders report, one of yours, talking about Microsoft censoring the Chinese version of MSN The Space's blog tool. You can't enter search strings like democracy or human rights in China or capitalism. They're automatically rejected. Google withdrawing certain news and information sources from its the Chinese version of its search engine. Secure Computing selling Tunisia technology that allows it to censor news. Others doing the same kind of thing in Burma. Cisco training Chinese engineers in how to use its products to censor the Internet. But yet, there's global competition out there. These companies say they have to be out there selling and in it. What should American companies do, Julien Penn?
First, it's not a new situation. We've been monitoring the activity of these Internet giants for many years now, and we've been denouncing what they're doing in China, in Iran, and in other repressive regimes for a long time. So it got a lot of attention recently because of the Yahoo Shitaho case and because of this Microsoft case. But, I mean, it's a long story. So we believe in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We believe in freedom of expression. And we believe that this declaration doesn't apply only to regular citizens and to diplomats. It also applies to corporate, to big companies. And the problem is that these companies just don't want to talk about that. They don't think they have to respect any ethical value while operating in these repressive regimes. So, for example, if you're trying to alert Microsoft on what they are doing in China, the fact that they are censoring words such as democracy, human rights, very basic words, they don't even pick up their phone and call us to discuss this issue. They just don't pay attention to what we're saying about that. They believe that they're just complying to the local legislation, and that's, you know, it's always the same excuse they're giving us. They don't want to talk about it because, you know, it's not illegal. It's maybe not illegal in China, but we think it's not ethical, and it goes against universal values that they should respect also.
Let me turn to New York and Tim Wu. Tim, as I said, we asked Yahoo, Microsoft, Google to talk about this, but they're lying low. As Julian Penn says, these companies often say, well, we're just following local law. But, of course, local law can be, often is, repressive. So what should American companies do here? What's the ethical line? What's the business line?
Well, I think it's a good the point that Julian made about the difference between ethics and legality is very important. I think the law in this area has been used as a bit of a smokescreen, speaking as a law professor, for the ethical question of whether it's right or wrong to be engaged in this kind of conduct. And if these companies really think that there's nothing illegal what they're doing and therefore nothing to be ashamed about, the question is, why aren't they a lot more open? Why don't they just admit freely, this is what we have to do in order to do business, this is the choices we've made, and this is why we're doing it? The truth is, I think they want to keep this under the radar screen because they're somewhat desperate to do business in China. And when companies get desperate, they do very silly things. We see that over and over again. So what I think companies should do is be just forthright about what they have to do. And to the extent possible, may I say this more about this in a second, put themselves in a position to resist the most ridiculous or most outrageous types of orders.
Ronald Ebert, in Toronto, can American companies be both ethical and successful when they're trying to work here globally with any number of governments who may want to intervene on the web?
Well, that's a big question. I think that the problem, as we've all been recognizing here, is that the corporations face essentially a PR issue. They want to be involved in the marketing of these technologies, but realize that it's not good press to have a radio show like this going on where people are talking about how Microsoft is contributing to the removal of bloggers or Yahoo is helping to throw someone in jail. So I personally think, though, that there is an opportunity here to bring these corporations together and to engage in some sort of dialogue on if not regulations and some sort of industry practices that could be perhaps self-governed. I may be a bit idealistic about that, but I think over the long run, these corporations are going to begin to realize that they can't get away with this. I'll give you one example from our research. When we were doing our testing in Burma, we documented the use of an American product called Fortinet. Mm-hmm. And when we contacted the company, they denied it, that they were involved. But then we presented in our report with, firm evidence that this company was involved. And they issue no comment and so on. These corporations can't get away with it. Groups like Reporters Without Borders, the Open Net Initiative, other groups out there are watching. They have the tools to be able to unearth what's going on beneath the surface, and you simply can't get away with it. So in the long run, unless these companies are willing to take massive hits in public relations, which I don't think they are, they're going to have to come together in some forum to discuss proper ethics.
But Burma's a little market. China is a huge one, hard to walk away from. And as Tim Wu says, a very set idea in the Chinese government about what it wants the internet to be and not to be. Julian Penn, let me ask you, at Reporters Without Borders, at this point, do you see the internet evolving more toward a forum that promotes freedom or a technology that promotes repression?
Well, the idea that the internet would provide freedom for everybody, that all repressive regimes would collapse because of the power of the internet, I mean, we have to forget about that. It's not true, and we've been monitoring what's happening in these countries for many years now, and freedom of expression is not really fostered by the internet. That's not true. If you see what's happening in China, there were more freedom of expression 5 years ago than now, because the Chinese acquired, thanks to American companies, very sophisticated technology to monitor the internet, to crack down on cyber dissidents, and to prevent access to foreign websites. So, I mean, the margin the margin of these cyber dissidents and online journalists is getting is no longer less important than it was 5 years ago. So I think we have to fight against the idea that the the internet will free the world. And that's the idea that is defended by big corporations like Cisco and like Microsoft. I mean, I talked about that with John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what he told me. He told me that on the long run, the internet and Cisco products will help the Chinese to get more information and access to free information. But what is the long run? And nobody knows. But what we see is that it's not the case. So I don't know what's going to happen in the future. Maybe in 100 years, the internet will be a great tool. But so far, it's not.
We want to see it. We want to understand it as a technology for liberation. You described that technological power being turned around. Julien Penn with Reporters Without Borders in Paris. I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Ronald Ebert, if you could stand by for just a moment. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. I want to begin to bring them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Greetings. I would like to know why the government did not go through the FISA process on the in-country intercepts. Is anyone investigating the possibility that there might be thousands of intercepts carried out to aid the Republican Party rather than the security of the United States?
Now, here you're talking about the NSA program of wiretapping that the president ordered for outbound communications from the United States or international communications suspected to be with terrorists, but you're afraid there may be a penumbra around that that's nothing to do with security?
It was so easy to go through. Why hide it? Why? What possibly needs to be hidden?
Michael, let us pick that up, and I want to bring another voice into our conversation to help us do it. Joining us from West Palm Beach, Florida, is Declan McCullough. He's chief political correspondent for CNETnews.com. Declan McCullough, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Remind us of what's going on the web around the NSA project of security intercepts. What's happening now?
Sure. I think what Michael was referring to was a law enacted as part of the post-Watergate reforms called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, and that said, well, instead of having the president do surveillance surreptitiously in terrorist or national security cases, then we're going to create a special secret court that can at least do give some semblance of judicial oversight.
But that's all the way back in 1978, and now we have that stepped past by the president's order recently.
Exactly. After 9/11, President Bush authorized the NSA to eavesdrop on Americans' international communications, both email and telephone communications, without going through the FISA court. So the question is, why is that? We don't have a great answer. I mean, we're going to have congressional hearings over the next few weeks, and maybe we'll start having more knowledge of what's going on. But one thing is that if the NSA wants to do a blanket surveillance, maybe tapping into some fiber optic cables that carry a tremendous amount of international communications, then the FISA is not designed for that. Congress probably didn't intentionally do that. But if you want to do blanket surveillance, you're probably going to have to do it yourself without going through the FISA process.
And to Michael's specific question, what if the goals get twisted? What if, let's say, political surveillance came in here? Would that be trackable? Would it be knowable?
The problem with trying to answer these types of questions is that they often take decades for the information to come out. We know that under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI did use its eavesdropping power illicitly against political opponents. They wiretapped Supreme Court justices, Martin Luther King, and so on, even Eleanor Roosevelt. But it took decades for this information to come out. Maybe you have a whistleblower who is retiring, or you have a FOIA request that finally goes through. So we just don't know what's going on. This is what we're trying to find out. What's in the hearings next month may help.
Now, Tim Wu, just in the last couple of days, we've seen the headlines about the U.S. government subpoenaing search record data from Microsoft, Yahoo, AOL, and Google. The first three gave it up. Google has not. They want to know, I guess, about how this is related to an anti-pornography, online pornography law. They want to know how much child pornography is being sought on the web. So Is that how do you see that ethically? Is that just a kind of standard procedure? They want aggregated general information on searches. Is that an infringement of civil liberties or just good record keeping by the government?
Yeah, well, the Google case raises slightly different cases. It's a case where they've, in pursuit of an entirely different goal, they're trying to establish the constitutionality of a law banning pornography on the internet. They've subpoenaed all these search engines to try and prove their government subpoenaed these to try and improve their case in that individual case. So it raises it doesn't raise the same kind of direct privacy issues that the NSA listening reading people's email does, but it does have serious consequences in the sense that it establishes this sort of precedent of using search engines as this massive reservoir of information, these giant sort of pools of information that are out there for governments to, particularly now our government, to go and look for data in. And I think that is something to be concerned about.
Ronald Deibert, at the Open Net Initiative, how do you see that? Is Google right to hold out and say no, or are they getting in the way of protecting children from child pornography on the web?
Well, it's a difficult issue. There's definitely a balance to be struck there. But regardless of the, you know, the topic is a bit inflammable, I think the key issue here is to separate the topic and just address the issue of oversight and accountability. But just getting back to this area of eavesdropping, I think one thing you have to understand is this whole area of signals intelligence is the deepest of the deep black of intelligence collection. And you really have to be naive to think that this is something new or something just since 9/11.
Fred is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you so much for having this program. I am an employee of one of the world's biggest computer companies, not one mentioned in this case. And I think it's important that we call this what it is, and you have been really. This is collaboration with, how do you put it, tyranny, I suppose. Sounds funny for a liberal to use that word, but that's what it is. These people are collaborators in the subjugation of large numbers of people.
When you say these people, who do you mean? Who's collaborating?
I mean the corporate people who make the decisions, Microsoft, Google, who make the decision that they will enable any dictator or any repressive regime to repress others is a collaborator in that, and to my mind is a form of a criminal.
So what should happen here, Fred? You work in this business. What right. should these companies do?
I think for one thing, they should stop doing it, and they should agree to stop doing it, and there should be some sort of worldwide standards organization so they can all agree and take less of an economic hit. But number two, given that corporate morals seem to be a thing of the past, I think it's important for two things to happen. One, that employees actually raise their voices to management about this sort of thing. And I plan to write to my CEO today, say, what is our policy on this? And number two, I think the only way, the way the world is going, the international corporations are becoming even more powerful than many governments, the only way to really work on this is through a grassroots effort where I've never seen Microsoft as the big evil company, so I've never switched over to Linux before, but I think this is the time to do it. If they can't do things right, then you have to de-Microsoft your computer and do it on a mass grassroots level and find ways to take on Google in the same way. It's sort of the old passive resistance.
Fred, we've got it, and it's fascinating to hear a voice from inside the business, and we thank you for your call. Tim Wu, is it too late? I mean, does China already have enough homegrown technology at this point that it doesn't really – I mean, the American companies may be assisting it, but if they stopped, would China's concept of the surveilled and censored internet be set back or not?
I think it would be set back only marginally. There are now Chinese companies that have successfully adopted many American technologies. A major example is this company Huawei, and there are Chinese search engines and Chinese auction sites. And so there is a Chinese equivalent to many of these technologies. So it's not. Although I respect the spirit of the callers, and I think I don't think cooperation with these things is the right thing to do. It is true that it wouldn't necessarily be that effective to pull out entirely.
Ronald Deibert, how do you see it? Is there a way to put a kind of a harness on this globally, or is the web simply going to become something else? I mean, we're reading in the Wall Street Journal in the last couple of days about alternate internets, countries sort of beginning to make up their own versions that the U.S., you know, that don't tie back to the U.S. Commerce Department, which the general web does now, internet does now.
Yeah, I think the old conventional wisdom of the open, unrestricted internet is one I think we should put behind us and realize that there are choke points all throughout and up and down the internet that authorities and corporations can use to intervene and intercept and monitor communications. But that's only one side of the story. I think something that we should point out here, especially in this program, is that there is a flip side to this, and that's that many individuals and organizations are working on tools that provide users with privacy and security and ways to get around censorship. So it is a constant cat and mouse game. I just think that people need to be diligent and understand that we just can't take this technology for granted. It's being shaped actively by very powerful forces, and at first level we need to raise awareness, and then we need to begin to think about the rules that govern the technologies and the corporations and the states that control information infrastructures.
So there's no getting away from eternal vigilance as the price of liberty here, and yet, you know, that open internet was part of, I think for millions of people, what they saw as the DNA of this century, that it was going to promote liberty, that it was going to promote freedom, and that was awfully welcome. Let me get a call from Dylan in Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Dylan, you're on the air.
Hi. I used to actually build search engines a bit ago, and several years ago actually was hit with this issue as far as especially in relation to China. When we started talking to companies about providing search technology into Chinese portals, there was no obscurity or question as to what was going to happen. They basically said, if you want access to China, period, you must remove access to X sites about democracy and so on and so forth. And it's, as somebody who, you know, who builds these things and who does believe in, you know, the openness of the internet, it was something that was detestable. But what I'm hoping to hear from some of your guests
yes.
is what it is that we could really do in relation to building searches or search engines that would get us clear of these things. Like you talked something about some industry consortia, et cetera, even here back in the States,
yes.
right? I mean, you can be post-9/11, search engines can now be subpoenaed for queries and so on and so forth, and aren't even allowed to disclose that those subpoenas were granted.
Dylan, are you looking for a technical solution or a regulatory or political solution?
Either one. I mean, you know, sort of sitting back and saying, hey, look, I've got this issue of I can't stand this idea that we are participating or might be participating
yeah.
in this kind of restriction. And yet, I don't know what the alternative is.
Dylan, let us pick it up. Ronald Deibert, let me come to you. I mean, we read just in recent days about a weekly meeting in Beijing where companies, including American companies, are told what can and cannot be accessible through their technology on the internet. That's just about as overt a cooperation as you could have. Here's another caller from In the Business who wants to know concretely, okay, maybe it's going to be a long battle to keep this open, but what could or should be done?
Well, I think just what I said earlier, we need to actively promote and encourage the research and development of privacy-enhancing, security-enhancing technologies that allow individuals to get around censorship, and many do exist out there that do this job on a daily basis.
Would they work in a realm like China, where the government is so attuned? Well, we even read recently they have little graphic police cars that pass across your screen to remind you that they're watching. When Big Brother's watching that hard, can any technology escape the gaze?
Sure it can, and I think that, you know, China is a very difficult case because it throws so much resources into this issue compared to other countries around the world. But even notwithstanding the matrix of controls that China puts in place, individuals, human rights activists with great risk, and I'll underline that, with great personal risk, are able to sidestep these controls. But I think this is where, if we want to encourage technological solutions, putting aside the regulatory solutions for a minute, we need to begin to resurrect that original notion that really helped shape the internet at the beginning, this notion of hacking in its pure sense of the term, allowing individuals to develop tools that enhance freedom of speech, access to information, and encourage foundations like the Soros Foundation, Ford Foundation, to fund this type of research so that individuals can get around these controls. And I see it as the only way of trying to reclaim some of that freedom of speech and access to information that were once central characteristics of the internet.
Wow, hackers, keep it up. It sounds like we're counting on you to push the freedom part of the technology forward. Let me get one more call here. Jim is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a little disturbed about the talking about bypassing FISA and FISA, you know, and not being sufficient for doing mass monitoring. And you know, I think we can't really talk about having any regulatory solutions if we're not willing to talk about that when they're being broken. I mean, it's not bypassing FISA, it's breaking the law on FISA. And the government may argue that they have the right to do that, but they're not arguing that they haven't done it.
We've got it, Jim. Our time is short. Declan McCullough, what about it? Here are the courts that are supposed to, by law, since 1978, oversee this kind of wiretapping. The government has made its case again just yesterday. Alberto Gonzalez saying there's a different circumstance here. The president has the right. Do you see a technical justification here? Is there any reason that FISA is unworkable in the kind of environment that the U.S. government is in now?
If you want to do wholesale monitoring of thousands or millions of Americans, FISA is frankly not designed for that. But you'd figure that if you want to do that kind of broad monitoring, then it's the responsibility of the president to go to Congress and say, this is what we want to do, give us the ability to do that. And then one other quick point, it's tempting for us in the U.S. to say, well, you know, U.S. we have such a free society here, and U.S. companies should not do business with ones in less free countries. But I remember that in Canada, you had Canadian activists, privacy activists, union officials complaining about outsourcing Canadian data, that is data processing, to the U.S. because of the Patriot Act. They're saying that Canadian companies should basically not do business in the U.S. because of the alleged privacy intrusions enshrined in the Patriot Act. So the Americans have to be a little careful before saying, well, you know, we're so great here.
Tim Wu, a final thought. Cast your mind, I don't know, 40 or 50 years out. Are we going to see the web as a friend of freedom or not?
You know, it's a really great question. I would predict that looking on the long range, we are going to see an increase in these trends of balkanization, some of which I think, even though I agree with the thrust of the criticism, some of which is legitimate. Countries have some legitimate interests. The last thing I want to say, which is interesting, is the final check on this may be something called world trade law, that the WTO and its liberalization of services may in some range be a final check on some of these things. We don't have time to talk all about that, but maybe another time.
Grasping for straws, that might be a big one, to keep it open, to keep it free. It's been a fascinating conversation. Tim Wu at Columbia Law School, thank you very much for being with us. We'll look for your book. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure.
And Declan McCullough with CNetNews.com. Declan, thanks for joining us this hour.
Certainly.
And at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, Ronald Deavert. Ronald, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.